Chapter 16. The Gigantic Experiment. Man, therefore, may be said to have been trying an experiment on a gigantic scale, and it is an experiment which nature, during the long lapse of time, has incessantly tried. Charles Darwin, The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication. From his first hour on San Cristobal, when he shoved a hawk off a branch with the muzzle of his gun, and saw a finch swatted dead with a hat, Darwin knew that the birds of the Galapagos had no experience with human beings. When he mentions the Galapagos birds in his journal, it is almost always to exclaim at their appalling innocence. "I saw a boy sitting by a well with a switch in his hand, with which he killed the doves and finches as they came to drink," Darwin writes after visiting the prison colony on Floriana. "He had already procured a little heap of them for his dinner, and he said he had constantly been in the habit of waiting there for the same purpose. One day," Darwin writes, "a mockingbird alighted on the edge of a pitcher, made of the shell of a tortoise, which I held in my hand whilst lying down. It began very quietly to sip the water, and allowed me to lift it with the vessel from the ground. I often tried and very nearly succeeded in catching these birds by their legs." Darwin had been reading the second volume of Lyell's Principles of Geology, which he received in his mail at the port of Montevideo. The whole volume is an argument against the possibility of evolution, but Lyell does write about the changes that an invader might bring to an island. When the first polar bears landed in Iceland on an iceberg, for instance, the chaos must have been terrific, Lyell argues. The bears must have feasted on the deer, the foxes, the seals, even some of the birds. With fewer deer on the island, the local plants would have prospered, and also the insects that fed on the plants. With fewer foxes, the ducks would have multiplied, thinning the schools of fish. In this way, the settling of one new species, Lyell wrote, might alter the numerical proportions of a great number of the inhabitants, both of the land and sea, and the changes caused indirectly might ramify through all classes of the living creation and be almost endless. For Darwin, the tameness of the Galapagos birds became a symbol of Lyell's lesson. That is how Darwin closes his chapter on the Galapagos in his Journal of Researches, after describing the tameness of the birds. "We may infer from these facts," he writes, "what havoc the introduction of any new beast of prey must cause in a country, before the instincts of the aborigines become adapted to the stranger's craft or power." Darwin elaborates the point in a famous passage in The Origin, a passage that helped establish the science of ecology. "A web of complex relations binds all of the living things in any region," Darwin writes. "Adding or subtracting even a single species causes waves of change that race through the web, onwards in ever-increasing circles of complexity. The simple act of adding cats to an English village would reduce the number of field mice. Killing mice would benefit the bumblebees, whose nests and honeycombs the mice often devour. Increasing the number of bumblebees would benefit the heartsease and red clover, which are fertilized almost exclusively by bumblebees. So adding cats to the village could end by adding flowers." For Darwin, the whole of the Galapagos archipelago argues this fundamental lesson. The volcanoes are much more diverse in their biology than their geology. The contrast suggests that in the struggle for existence, species are shaped at least as much by the local flora and fauna as by the local soil and climate. Why else would the plants and animals differ radically among islands that have the same geological nature, the same height, climate, etc.? "This long appeared to me a great difficulty," Darwin writes toward the end of The Origin, "but it arises in chief part from the deeply seated error of considering the physical conditions of a country as the most important for its inhabitants, whereas it cannot, I think, be disputed that the nature of the other inhabitants, with which each has to compete, is at least as important, and generally a far more important element of success. when each seed and bird arrived on one of these islands, he says, it would have to compete with different sets of organisms, and it would be exposed to the attacks of somewhat different enemies. If then it varied, natural selection would probably favor different varieties in the different islands. Again, Darwin never actually saw this happen. But he concluded that the introduction of a new species anywhere on Earth might be an evolutionary event, that small invasions can have far-reaching consequences. The invader itself evolves rapidly as it adapts to its new home. Meanwhile, everything already living there either adapts to the invader or becomes extinct. The result is an expanding pulse of evolution and extinction, a general acceleration of the pace of change. In the past, the pace of travel was generally slow. The finch had to wait for the freak wind. The polar bear had to wait for the iceberg. The union and disunion of continents were limited by the pace of continental drift, which is measured in centimeters per year. Today, invasions on this scale are happening every day, and virtually every spot on the surface of the planet is being assaulted by varied new evolutionary pressures. Invaders ride in the puddles of old car tires, the bilge water of ships, the pressurized cabins of airplanes, in suitcases, on pant legs, and on mud-caked shoe soles. These are Darwin's old jelly jar experiments replayed in earnest. The consequence is an intensification of Darwinian pressures, not only in the Galapagos, but everywhere we look. The Yankee evolutionist, Herman Cary Bumpus, witnessed one small step of an invasion at the close of Darwin's century. On the last day in January 1898, Providence, Rhode Island was struck by a howling blizzard. The storm blocked the streetcars and the railroad trains, snapped the telegraph and telephone lines, and threw sparks from dangling wires onto the shingled roof of Walter H. Willis's furnishing store. According to the front-page story in the next day's Providence Journal, the fire was put out with snowballs by a crowd of merrymakers. Bumpus was teaching biology at Brown University. His path to work each morning led up College Hill and past the Providence Athenaeum, one of the oldest libraries in the United States. The morning after the storm, as he made his way through the snow, he happened to notice a large number of English sparrows lying dead or exhausted in the drifts beneath the Athenaeum. The sparrows had been wintering in the ivy that covered the library, and the gale had overwhelmed them. These sparrows were newcomers to New England, as Bumpus knew. Old world birds in the New World. One of the first pairs had been released in New York's Central Park in 1851, the decade before Bumpus was born, by an eccentric bird lover who wanted to import every one of the birds in Shakespeare's plays to the United States. So the birds were lying in the snow that morning, in part because Shakespeare had written, "There is a special providence in the fall of a sparrow." Bumpus collected as many of the sparrows as he could and brought them to the anatomical laboratory. In the warmth of the lab, 72 of the sparrows revived. 64 died. He recorded the sex, body length, wingspans, and weight of both the living and the dead. He also measured the length of the head, the humerus, the femur, the tibiotarsus, the skull, and the sternum. When he tabulated all these results, he found that most of the survivors were males, and that among the males, the survivors tended to be shorter and lighter than average, with longer wing bones, longer legs, longer sternums, and greater brain capacity. At the time, English sparrows were multiplying and overrunning the continent. Bumpus believed that the English sparrow, since its introduction into this country, has found life so easy that the operation of natural selection has been practically suspended, and that the American type consequently has become degenerate. The birds that had died in the storm were those that had diverged most from the original type. It was an episode of what is now called stabilizing selection. In the early 1970s, just before his first trip to the Galapagos, Peter Grant reread Bumpus's paper and studied the tables of numbers. The paper had long since become one of the most famous studies ever conducted of evolution in action. Peter reanalyzed the data using more powerful statistical tools. He concluded that Bumpus had actually seen not one, but two kinds of natural selection. For the female sparrows, the storm was stabilizing. The event killed the largest and the smallest, but preserved the mean, just as Bumpus had said. In the males, however, the pressure of the storm was directional, pushing the birds towards smaller size. The reanalysis of Bumpus's classic data helped to inspire the Grants' first trip to the Galapagos. There was a providence in the fall of those sparrows. If you could demonstrate natural selection under those freakish conditions, Peter and Rosemary wondered what they could see under more normal conditions. They might not be able to see it at all. Today, English sparrows are still evolving and adapting to North America, and to South America, South Africa, Hawaii, Australia, and New Zealand, through Darwin's process. So are barnacles that invaded the Salton Sea during World War II, riding in with the U.S. Navy. So are fruit flies that invaded Chile in the 1970s. With these species and many others, biologists are now tracking evolution in action, quite confident, as the Grants and other studies pile up, that the process can be watched. Each of these creatures, now that we have put it down in a new place in the world, is in the middle of a crisis, an epical event, like the first finches to land in the Galapagos, and their evolution, like the finches, is turning out to be rapid. Whenever we introduce an alien to a new country, we also change life for the natives. Lyell's point in the parable of the polar bear, and Darwin's in his vision of cats helping flowers. This kind of chain of events is going on everywhere, too, and it, too, is being watched. The evolutionist Scott Carroll of the University of Utah is proving the point with the beak of the soapberry bug. This is a bug with a long needle of a proboscis, which is, in effect, its beak. The bug pokes its beak through the walls of fruit, pierces the walls of the seeds, and then liquefies and sucks up the nutrients, as if it were sipping cider through a straw. Carroll, who is one of the tallest biologists in the world, has spent many of his working hours in the last few years stooping over soapberry bugs from Yavapai County, Arizona, to Key Largo, Florida. They are New World bugs, rather pretty-looking things. Carroll paints black numbers on their backs to keep track of individuals and watches them eat. At the start of his study, he says, he assumed they would be like little wind-up automata, but they are not. Privately, he has come to believe as he watches them that they are each different, with personalities. But that is off the subject of his quest. In the south-central United States, soapberry bugs live on the soapberry tree. In southernmost Texas, they live on the sirhanya vine. In southern Florida, they live on the perennial balloon vine. These are its native hosts. The bug and these plants go back thousands of years.